So he's saying, hey, how are you justified? By the works of the law or by faith? The obvious answer is by faith. And he says, okay then, well, that's the same way you're sanctified, by faith, not by the flesh. That is, not by the works of the law. So that puts the lie to the whole idea that you'd be sanctified by law. And we're justified by faith, but sanctified by the Old Covenant law. Okay. Now the rest of Galatians chapter 3 is about the law of Moses in relation to faith and relation to being justified. And so far, the whole issue has been the issue of being justified by faith versus being justified by the law. Because that's the false gospel these Judaizers were bringing into this assembly. They were saying you needed to obey the Torah in order to really be faith in Jesus is not enough. So one of the things Paul discusses in chapter 3 is the relationship between Abraham and the law, between faith and the law. And now up until this point, no other law is being referred to, no other law. Every one of the 21 references to the law so far in chapters 1 through 3, they have been a reference to the law of Moses, no other law. No mention of any pagan or Gentile laws has been made. Now we go to chapter 4. Chapter 4, Paul says this, 4, 1 through 5. He says, now I say of all, but as under tutors and governors until the time appointed of the Father, even so we, when we were children, were in bondage under the elements of the world. Okay? We, when we were children, were in bondage under the elements of the world. But when the fullness of time was come, God sent forth his Son, made of a woman, made under the law, to redeem them who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons. When you look at this in your eyes, you can see there's a connection there. There's a connection between being under the elements and being under the law, okay? And it's wonderful how the scripture interprets itself. Because of that, we're not left, you know, trying to figure things out with our human brain. Paul says that when we were children, we were in bondage under the elements of the world. Okay, he's included himself again. He's identified with the Gentiles. So what exactly are the elements of the world? You read on, he says, when time was right, God sent Jesus into the world to redeem them that were under the law. He's equating under the elements of the world with being under the law, very clearly. So when you walk under the law of Moses, you're walking under the elements of this world. That's the meaning of that verse. Next, Paul says in Galatians 4, 8 through 12, he says, howbeit then, when you knew not God, you did service unto them by nature. How turn ye again to the weak and beggarly elements, the elements, whereunto you desire again to be in bondage? You observe days and months and times and years. I'm afraid of you, lest I have bestowed upon you labor in vain. Now that shows you the seriousness of what we're talking about here. When people go back under the law, the person who saved them, the salvation. It's a very important, deadly serious issue here. Now, of course, according to Mr. Scott, like he said, these Galatians were returned to the weak and beggarly elements of paganism, not Judaism, of course, because that's where they came from. His mind is you can't return to something else from which you came. You came from paganism, you're going to return to paganism. And he's saying they'll return to their former ways of worship and religion. He's saying the weak and beggarly elements is, you know, the pagan ways, your old pagan ways, your old pagan gods. Well, if this be the case, if his logic is correct, then it was the Judaizers who had come into that fellowship who were trying to turn the Gentiles back to their pagan ways. Or you see, the problem with this church is clearly stated repeatedly and specifically to be the influence of the Judaizers. The Judaizers who secretly crept in with a false gospel and were having a bad influence on the people. So if the pagans were turning to the pagan Gentile Christians of Galatia were returning to their pagan roots, they were doing that at the behest of the Judaizers. That's what the Judaizers were telling them to do, because that's the whole problem. Okay? A false gospel brought in by Judaizers. Next, Paul says in 4:17 through 22, he says, they zealously affected, but not well. Yea, they would exclude you, that ye might affect them. But it is good to be zealously affected, always in a good thing, and on whom I travail in birth again, until Christ be formed in you. I desire to be present with you now, and change my voice, for I stand in doubt of you. Tell me, ye that desire to be under the law, do you not hear the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by the bondmaid, and the other by the free woman. Okay, then he goes on to explain the difference between Sarah and Hagar, their two covenants. So he says, you who desire to be under the law, not the pagan laws, not the pagan days, not the pagan months. It's the law of Moses we're talking about here. You who desire to be under the law, do you not hear the law? For it is written in the Jewish law that Abraham had two sons, okay? They, the Judaizers, had come from Jerusalem, and they were affecting the believers in Galatia. They're affecting them by causing them to start to observe Jewish laws, Jewish customs. They're trying to get to obey the Jewish law of circumcision. They're trying to get to obey the Jewish laws concerning holy days. That would be primarily the Sabbath. Of new Jewish new moons, that'd be, you know, the months, and so on. So to say that Paul was telling Galatians not to revert back to their pagan ways, again, that would mean this is what the Judaizers were encouraging them to do. And I say, excuse me, Mr. Scott, do you really expect us to believe that the Judaizers, who had infiltrated that assembly and who were zealously affecting those people, were trying to turn them or revert them back to their pagan ways, to their pagan gods, to their pagan days, months, and times, and years? Give me a break. The Judaizers of Paul's day would no more encourage Gentile believers to return to their pagan ways than Mr. Scott would encourage today's Gentile believers to return to their pagan ways. Jews don't try to bring Gentiles into pagan bondage. Jews try to bring Gentiles into Jewish bondage. And that's exactly what's going on in the book of Galatians. As a matter of fact, you go through the book of Galatians, and the term the law is used 33 times in that book. 33 times. And in every single instance, it's a reference to the law of Moses. Not once is it a reference to any other kind of law. The only law in the book of Galatians is the law of Moses. And so the only times, days, weeks, and months in Galatians are the Jewish laws, times, days, weeks, and months. All right? When Paul warned the Gentiles not to turn again to the weak and beggarly elements of this world, what he meant is crystal clear if you keep what he said in context of the entire book of Galatians and not the rabbinical writings of blind, unsaved Jews. He was talking about the law of Moses, which the Judaizers were trying to impose on these people to put their trust in for justification. Anything we place our trust in for justification is a weak and beggarly element compared to faith. And that includes the law of Moses. Let me say it again. Anything that we place our trust in for justification is a weak and beggarly element of the world, and that includes the law of Moses. All right? Mr. Scott tries to refute, to show that the Gentiles are not free from the law, is in the book of Hebrews. If you all are aware of the book of Hebrews, where the writer there says that, talks about the different priesthood, and he says if perfection could have been brought through the Levitical priesthood, then the coming of another priest and another priesthood wouldn't be necessary. Then he says there's also been a change of the law. There's been a change of the law. That's in Hebrews 7:12. Well, apparently someone wrote to Mr. Scott, you know, and asked if that phrase, you know, change in the law, and change of the priesthood, if all that means that we're no longer obliged to obey the Torah. This is what he says to that question. It never ceases to amaze me the conclusions people come to when reading passages for the express purpose of finding something, anything, that appears to denigrate Torah. So, see, his view is anything you say that might mean that you don't have to obey the law is denigrating the law. You know, in his mind, the law is just as holy as God, and you're in rebellion if you don't obey that law. And even just saying I don't need to obey it is to denigrate it. Okay? He worships the law. He doesn't worship God. He worships the law. Okay, he says, one has to do some terrific mental gymnastics to draw that conclusion here. But I am asked this often enough to address it for those who do not know how to respond to it. First, let me begin by saying that this book, as the book of Hebrews, is not called the letter to the Evrim Hebrews for nothing. The whole thing in this book is to reveal it to the Hebrew people that the Messiah is after the order of Melchizedek, with a better priesthood, a better covenant, which is built on better promises, and a better sacrifice. Nothing in this book addresses the abolition or the abolishment of the law, halakhic or haggadic laws. You know, he's talking about the regular law. All the language of the next several chapters point to the change of the Torah concerning the priesthood. There is no mention whatsoever of any changes in the Torah concerning Shabbat, Yahweh's feasts, dietary laws, health laws, murder, theft, laws of clean and unclean, marriage laws before Yahweh. This is what the priesthood is all about. Sacrifice and offerings did not take the place of the earthly ramifications of murder, theft, adultery, or any other crimes. Sacrifice and offerings did not nullify Shabbat or take the place of feasts or substitute for our diet or heal anyone of leprosy or become the city of refuge when someone's brother-in-law was after them. Sacrifice rescued us from death, for the wages of sin is death. Sacrifice and the offerings made peace between Elohim and man through a priesthood in a temple. That priesthood has been made higher and eternal by Messiah. And so the law concerning the priesthood has been made higher as well. So his whole point is, nothing's changed with the law, basically. You're still under all the law. You still must obey the Torah. You still got to obey the feast, the dietary laws, the health laws. You know, you still can't murder a lot. Whatever was going on with the new covenant and a better priesthood and a better priest, it just made it more eternal. It's made something better. It's not really that different. This whole argument regarding this passage about the change of the law is that this and everything else is written in the book of Hebrews. It's just an installment of a new priesthood. That's all it's about. Really, it's nothing about a new covenant. The two covenants are the same. It's not a new covenant. It's a renewed covenant. It's a renewal of the old covenant. Same basic old covenant. So it's not really a change of the covenant. It's just a change of the priesthood. So we're just relate to the law a little bit differently. But we still got to keep it. He says, none of what is written in the whole book of Hebrews has anything to do with the abolishment of the laws of the Old Testament. He goes on to say this. He says, all the language of the next several chapters points to the change of the priesthood. There is no mention whatsoever of any change in the Torah concerning Shabbat, Yahweh's feast, dietary laws, etc. In my view, the central theme of the book of Hebrews is the contrast between the Old and New Covenants. The particular specific issue of the priesthood being changed is only part of the overall line of thought. The overall situation is a whole new covenant. When a whole brand new covenant comes into being, there has to be a new priesthood, and new priest, and all that kind of stuff. The priesthood in Hebrews 7 is just one specific detail of the entire covenant being changed, an old and a new one, okay? So while the 7th chapter of Hebrews concerns the change of a priesthood from Levitical to Melchizedek, the 8th chapter of Hebrews describes the difference between the covenants themselves. The old one, the first one, is ready to vanish, the writer says, while the other one is new. Okay? That's why I read you this passage from 8, chapter 8 of Hebrews, 7 to 13, because you can't get around this. The writer of Hebrews says, for if that first covenant had been faultless, then should no place have been sought for the second, as a second covenant. Okay? For finding fault with them, he said, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant when I took them out of the hand, took them by the hand and led them out of Egypt. Because they continue not in my covenant, and I regard them not, saith the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord. I will put my laws into their mind, and write them in their hearts, and I will be to them a God, and they shall be to me a people, and they shall not teach every man his neighbor, and every man his brother, saying, know the Lord. For all shall know me, from the least to the greatest. For I will be merciful to their transgressions, and their sins and their iniquities will I remember no more. In that he saith a new covenant, he hath made the first old. In that he saith a new covenant, he hath made the first old. Now that which decayeth and waxeth old is ready to vanish away. To vanish away. So the writer of Hebrews states that the first covenant has been replaced by a new covenant, by a second covenant. I mean, the very term new covenant means that the original covenant is now old. In that he saith a new covenant, he hath made the first one old. He hath made the first one old. It's God who makes it old. That's very important, see, because what all these Messianic Jews and Gentiles are accusing us of doing is we're trying to make it old. We're trying to do away with the old covenant. We're trying to avoid the old covenant. We're trying to avoid the law. But I just want to tell all those Jews, all those Gentiles, all you legalists out there, it wasn't anti-Torah Gentiles who made the first covenant old, thank you. It wasn't the Pope who made the first covenant old. It was God who made the first covenant old, by establishing a new one, okay? The writer of Hebrews, makes it clear, at the time that letter was written, the first covenant was decaying. The first covenant was waxing old. And the first covenant was about to vanish. It was on the verge of vanishing. Not only was the first covenant no longer the covenant God was concerned with, God was fixing to make the whole thing vanish. Vanish means disappear. There's no other way to understand that word. That's what it means. It's important to understand, because people don't understand, what does this mean, vanish? It was decaying and waxed old then. It was ready to vanish then. But when did it actually vanish? When did it actually go away? I mean, when is it done? The writer of Hebrews doesn't say that. Well, you know why the writer of Hebrews doesn't say that? Because it vanished after the writer of Hebrews wrote that. Okay? The book of Hebrews was written before the temple of Jerusalem was destroyed. Okay? Everybody understand that? Realize that? The book of Hebrews was written before the temple of Jerusalem was restored. Now, there's various claims. Various people have the date for the writing of Hebrews within 20, 30 years of each other. But one thing in Hebrews 13:23, it makes mention of Timothy being released from prison. Okay, Timothy's being released from prison is in Hebrews 13:23. That's proof that the book of Hebrews was written in the late 60s. And the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. So the book of Hebrews was written in the 60s, most likely the late 60s, and the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. So when the writer of the book of Hebrews penned those words about the first covenant waxing old and decaying and ready to vanish, the temple was still standing. Even though Jesus had been crucified and raised from the dead, even though a new covenant had been established, blind, obstinate Jews continued to practice Judaism in their temple. But a few years after the writer of Hebrews penned those words, God destroyed their temple. He destroyed that temple. In so doing, he made it impossible for Jews to practice biblical Judaism ever again. Ever again. The day the temple was destroyed, that was the day the law of Moses vanished. Vanished. Done, complete, kaput, gone. Nobody has ever been able to obey or observe the law as it was given to Moses on Mount Sinai since that day. In order to obey the law, you must have a temple where animal sacrifices are offered. You must have a temple and a priesthood that is ordained to offer those sacrifices. In order to obey the law as given to Moses, you must have a temple also for all the other offerings. There's many other offerings that weren't sacrificial offerings for sin or wickedness. You know, they had nothing to do with sin and redemption. And the animals weren't used. Like we were going through the feast the other 2 weeks. You have to have a temple. You have to have priests to offer the first sheaf of the barley. You know, the first fruits during the Passover. You have to have a temple and a priest to do that. During Pentecost, you have to have a temple. You have to have priests to offer the 2 loaves during the Feast of Weeks, during the Feast of Pentecost. Okay, and it goes on and on and on. You can't celebrate the Feast of Israel, literally, without a temple. It's impossible. And people who try to follow the literal Feast of Israel, they're only fooling themselves. Because in order to really observe those feasts, not only must you have a temple, you have to live in the land. You have to live in the land of Israel. There's no provision in the written law. In the law of Moses, what was written. There's no provision there for observing the commandments of the Sabbath, the feast, and the new moons and all that outside of Israel, outside the land. Okay? Those laws were given for those who were in the land. And you can only obey them in the land. According to Moses, you must have a temple. And you must be living in the land to properly observe the various feasts. Forget the sacrifices. Forget the sin offerings, which Jesus replaced by his own blood. You still have to be in the land and have a temple to do all the other things. So people who try to keep the law without a temple, without joining the land of Israel, they're not obeying the Torah. They're rebelling against the Torah. They're blind fools. Now, one of the things Messianic Jews and wannabe Jews, what they do to deceive Gentile Christians into bondage to the law, is they say that the new covenant is not really a new covenant. Okay? Rather, they say it's only a renewed covenant. Okay, that is, it's a renewal. It's a renewal, a revival of the first covenant. And they try to say the Greek word koinos there, which means new. It doesn't carry the connotation of something coming into existence that was not in existence before. It doesn't carry all the connotations of what we normally think of when we think of the new covenant. Instead, they claim the word simply means it's a new interpretation or a new understanding or a new way of relating to something that is already in existence. Okay, the old covenant was waxing old, and so the new covenant is just they come along, puffed it up, and get a facelift, and now we're in a new covenant, which is basically the old covenant renewed. Okay, that's their line, and they use they twist the Greek term kenos to substantiate that lie. They try to find that Greek term like that because the real meaning of koinos makes it clear that new covenant is a completely different thing from the old covenant. It's different. It's not a renewal of anything. It's a different thing. It's new in time, it's new in character, it's new in purpose. The term renew removes this radical distinctiveness between the old and new covenant. And so they do all these lies and twistings of the scripture, twisting of the Greek, and perversions to trick the stupid Gentiles into go back in on the law. You know, and each year more and more Gentiles succumb to that deception. Okay, last example there's about 15 scriptures to go through. I could make a whole series on this, as well as the other arguments these Messianic Jews use, but I'm not going to do that. The last example from this guy's list, it's a supposed refutation, the clear meaning of Ephesians 2, 14 through 16, about the middle wall partition being taken down, having been abolished and all that, okay? This is what it says. For he is our peace, who hath made both one, and hath broken down the middle wall partition between us, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, even the law of commandments contained in ordinances, for to make in himself of the twain one new man, so making peace, and that he might reconcile both unto God in one body by the cross, having slain the enmity thereby. Now, Mr. Scott gives a long dissertation on why this passage doesn't mean what it actually plainly states. Okay, I'm not going to go through all of it. I'll just give you a basic overview here. His view of Christ breaking down the middle wall that divides is that it's a reference to restoring the division of Israel from the two kingdoms, the 10 northern tribes and 2 southern tribes. Restoring those two things into one kingdom again. The 10 northern tribes were scattered among the Goyim, among the Gentiles, thousands of years ago. in the last days, or in his view, at the time of the cross, God's gathering the 10 tribes. And he's going to unite them back with Judah, the two southern tribes. This guy must have been reading the writings of a couple of Jews called Angus and Batya Wooten, who have several books out there, who were part of the Messianic Jewish movement at one time, but came out of that movement and went off to formulate their own peculiar doctrine of the 10 lost tribes. And what they teach is the same basic thing this guy's teaching right here. They call it the House of Israel. So now, as I just quote here, you ask yourself what he means by the term Gentiles in the context of this teaching. Are these Gentiles actually biological Gentiles, or are they actually biological Hebrews of the 10 northern tribes? I'll give you a quote of what he's saying here. He starts this article out by saying, the God of Israel from the beginning has only one son. The earthly representation of this son, Israel, disobeyed, they sinned, and was divided into two sons, Ephraim and Judah, or two kingdoms. The northern kingdom made up of 10 tribes, and the southern kingdom made up of Judah, Benjamin, and a good portion of the Levites. These two kingdoms, called the House of Israel and the House of Yehuda, Judah, had two distinct prophecies told of them. According to Isaiah chapter 1 through 3, the kingdom of the House of Israel, which is 10 northern tribes, would dissolve and be scattered throughout the nations, the Gentiles. They would no longer be the people of Yahweh, and Yahweh would no longer have mercy on them. But Yahweh, by virtue of omniscience, knew that one day these two houses would be united. One day these two houses would be reunited, okay? And would once again be his people, with one shepherd, one head, and be renewed again as one man, Israel, his firstborn. There was, however, a mystery that both houses were blinded of, that is now revealed to the holy apostles and prophets. The mystery of the Messiah is, who is the house of Israel? Shaul reveals this mystery in the chapter following, the removal of the middle wall. The house of Israel comes from among the Gentiles, okay? The house of Israel comes from among the Gentiles. Then he says, the context of verse 14 to 15 tells us what has been abolished. The answer is the wall of verse 14. Every teacher and student of Scripture should ask themselves, is the wall that is being abolished Torah? Of course, his mind's no. And then he goes on to quote some scriptures about death being abolished. He quotes Romans 6:6, 2 Timothy 1:10, and 1 Corinthians 5:16. And all these verses talk about a law of about death being abolished or Jesus overcoming death. And his point is, this is what he says. He says, it's important to keep in mind that the wall that divides is written in the Torah. According to the commandments and ordinances, if you sin, then you are separated from Yahweh. There are penalties in Torah for sin and disobedience. There are no penalties for keeping Torah, only for disobeying Torah. It is absurd to conclude that Torah itself has been abolished, but rather the ultimate penalty for breaking Torah, which is death. Remember that both houses were dispersed because of sin, so it is that both houses will be restored by trusting and following the Messiah, the restorer of the breach. When anyone, Jew or Gentile, repents and believes on Messiah, their sins are forgiven, the penalty has been paid, and the wall has been removed. Simply put, the middle wall partition that has been abolished is the very thing that always divides. Sin, that which has always divided the sheep, caused the separation between Yahweh and his people. Shaul finishes this verse by revealing again that this reunion has made shalom or completeness of that which has been broken and scattered. What was broken and scattered is being made complete. What's broken and scattered is the two Hebrew houses of Judah and the house of Israel. Several times it says both houses will be restored. Okay, so I'm going to decipher this double talk a little bit. And then this is pretty hard to get when you're just talking to a mic. You download the notes, so be clear as you read them again. All right, if you're interested, I mean. First of all, he says Israel was divided in two houses. All right, the northern 10 tribes and the southern 2 tribes. He says that God, in his omniscience, knew that one day these two houses would be reunited and would once again be his people. Then he asks, who is the house of Israel? Who is the northern 10 tribes? It's going to be regathered and rejoined to Judah. His answer is, the house of Israel comes from among the Gentiles. Okay? The house of Israel comes from among the Gentiles. Then he says, both houses were dispersed because of sin, and so it is that both houses will be restored by trusting and following the Messiah. Okay? See, even though he supposedly answers the question of who Israel is, who's the house of Israel, he really didn't. See, all he said was, the house of Israel will come from among the Gentiles. The house of Israel will come from among the Gentiles. He didn't say whether these people are actually biological Hebrews or they are biological Gentiles. He just says they're going to come from the Gentiles. But when he says Israel, the house of Israel is going to come from among the Gentiles, he's giving you, the reader, the distinct impression that these people will be Gentiles, real biological Gentiles. Unfortunately, I believe that's a ruse. The same house that was scattered throughout the nations is the same house as being restored. That house is a Hebrew house, not a Gentile house. It's the Hebrew 10 northern tribes that are being restored and reunited with the Hebrew 2 southern tribes of Judah through the cross in this guy's mind. So that's the whole thing. There's been a wall partition put up. And it's not between the true Gentiles, biological Gentiles, and biological Jews. It's between two different houses of the biological Hebrews. And Jesus died on the cross. He's going to turn out that wall and bring the two biological houses, Hebrew houses, together, because no longer you're going to have to be punished with death and separation from God for disobeying the law. Jesus took all the penalty for you disobeying the law, and there's no wall there now. Jesus took the wall down when he forgave us. In this guy's mind, the wall is a penalty that comes upon every man who breaks the law. It's first and foremost separation from God. You know, in other words, a wall of separation is erected between us and the Lord when we disobey the law. Then we must be put to death. First separation, that is the wall, then death for those who disobey the law. And that's why he says, when a Jew or Gentile repents, believes the Messiah, quote, their sins are forgiven, the penalty has been paid, which is the wall, and so the wall has been removed. And I say, okay, after listening to these bizarre, wacko ideas, let's look at what the context of what Paul said about the middle wall partition being broken down. You look at the context, just a few verses back, and the whole thing is very clear. This guy is a nutcase, deluded nutcase, all right? This is what Paul says in Ephesians 2:11 through 19. Wherefore, remember that ye being in times past Gentiles, that means you're not Hebrews, they're not scattered Hebrews, they're not Hebrews who lost their identity, they're not Hebrews who forgot they were Hebrews, they are Gentiles in the flesh, they are bloodline, genealogical, DNA Gentiles, all right? Remember, therefore, that ye, being in times past Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision by that which is called you, you Gentiles in the flesh, you who have no Hebrew blood in you, you were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now in Christ Jesus, ye who were sometimes were far off are made nigh by the blood of Christ. For he is our peace, who hath made both one, and hath broken down the middle wall of partition between us, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, even the law of commandments contained in ordinances, for to make of himself of the twain one new man, so making peace. And that he might reconcile both unto God in one body by the cross, having slain the enmity thereby, and came and preached peace to you which were far off, that you who were far off are the Gentiles in the flesh, and to them which were nigh. Them which are nigh are Jews, according to the flesh. For through him we both, Gentiles in the flesh and Jews in the flesh, we both have access by one Spirit unto the Father. Now therefore ye, Gentiles into the flesh, are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints, the household of God. You're fellow citizens with the flesh and blood Jews. Now, first of all, it's clear beyond any shadow of a doubt here that Paul is talking to, and he's talking about Gentiles in the flesh, like I said, okay? He's not talking about the 10 scattered tribes of Israel, either before or after their dispersion. He's talking about genuine, biological Gentiles, Gentiles in the flesh. Second, he tells these Gentiles in the flesh what their status was before coming to Christ. He says they were without Christ. They were aliens from the commonwealth of Israel. They were strangers from the covenants of Israel, covenants of promise. They had no hope in this world, and they were without God. All right, that's pretty plain. The Gentile nations had no relationship with Israel or with Israel's God before Jesus came. They were strangers from the covenants of promise given to Israel by God. They were far off from God. They were far off from God's people, the Hebrews. They were aliens from the commonwealth of the nation of Israel. And they were without Christ and without hope. But now in Christ Jesus, these same Gentiles, after the flesh, have not only been brought close to Israel, they've actually become part of Israel. They have become part of the people of God, the original people of God. They have become part of the commonwealth, no longer strangers. They are no longer foreigners. Then Paul says, Jesus is our peace. He is the peace of both Jews and Gentiles, biological Jews and biological Gentiles, who put their trust in him for redemption. He also says that Jesus hath made both biological Jews and biological Gentiles, those who believe, he's made them one. That is, he's made them one spiritual body.